Hello everyone, I'm Michael Pernforce and this is Open Mic. Today with an American legend, two Grand Slam finals, best ranking in singles, number four, eight titles, Davis Cup winner, the list goes on and on, but here he is, Todd Martin, a gentleman on and off the court. Welcome, Todd.
Hey, Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Good to see you. Everything all right?
Likewise. Yeah, holding up.
All right, well, good. So a wonderful career, as we all know, but I'd like to know kind of how you got introduced to the game and you know, and what attracted it to you.
So I had athletic parents. My dad was a multi-sport athlete in high school and very recreational in a couple of sports when I was growing up. My mom was a phys ed teacher. She has her master's education in physical education. They sort of figured out that their common place or their best place to share athletic recreation was the tennis court. And from about 4 years old, I'd chase them up to the park courts. And if I behaved myself while they were playing, my dad let me hit a few balls at the end of their time. I took to it as sort of uber focused as a young boy and just started batting balls against every wall I could find. They started stacking up a picnic table and I loved it.
Oh, that's awesome. Was there another sport that could have been, or was it all tennis for you?
Well, no, I mean, every sport could have been. Every sport could have been for me. I couldn't have been for every sport. I loved playing. I loved athletics. Basketball was my first really deep love. But, you know, there was something about tennis. It's independence, it's self-reliance, the pain and the pleasure of knowing that I was owning it. As I grew up and became a teenager, it was clear that one, I was better wired for it. Two, I had the most amazing youth educator in tennis. So if for no other reason, I just wanted to be around the people of tennis or of my tennis. And then three, I just was clearly way better at tennis than I was at basketball. And at some point in time, that was pretty easy for me to realize. And yeah. I had aspirations to play athletics long into my life.
Okay. So then you're looking at getting in your teens, as you say, you're getting more and more serious. What did a week look like for you practice wise? You know, when you get into your teens there.
So I was untraditional to the nth degree in my opinion. While my peers, you know, Bollettieri's Academy was starting in the early 80s. And a few of my eventual peers, Currier Agassi were there. And then others, of my eventual peers, Chang and Sampras, were out in California outdoors all the time playing. I know a lot, probably, you know, three to four hours a day on most days. I grew up in mid Michigan. My parents could have afforded to get me to the indoor tennis club on a daily basis. They limited me to 3 days a week. So I was somewhere between 5 and 6 hours a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 2 hours from 3 to 5 in a group clinic. And then Friday from 3 to 4 with a private lesson and occasionally a little bit of extra. In the summer, I played all day, every day. But during the school year, I was expected to figure out how to satiate my exercise, extracurricular athletic desires by cross training, playing basketball in my neighbor's driveway, throwing the football around, playing tag with my friends, whatever it was. But I led for a tennis player, for an eventual professional tennis player, I think I led about as normal of a childhood as I possibly could have.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's great. And I wish that that was more of an objective, is to have kids play more sports. And I know it's a difficult situation compared to in the olden days, but I think you can benefit so much from getting involved in other sports.
It is. And I would have retrospectively, as somebody who has worked in player development, I wouldn't recommend 6 hours a week. That's not enough if you want to aspire to achieve what we achieved. I got lucky. I had the best possible educator I could have had as a young person and as a professional. And so it was the other people around me that really helped maximize my abilities. But at the same time, I do think that my parents had the right disposition about raising a boy to become a man, not a young athlete to become an adult athlete. And that I think is lost from time to time in the parental realm of junior tennis.
Yeah, I think it's sports. I understand exactly what you're saying. And it's funny that what you're saying is very similar to my upbringing. Now, I wasn't a very good junior, so it wasn't kind of that attitude. It was more a situation where, you know, tennis was a hobby, and if you get really good at it, maybe something comes out of it. But it's, you're doing it because you want to improve as a person and have something in your life that is something you can do for the rest of your life. So you kind of touched on it, but do you have a coach then that really inspired you? And tell us a little bit about that.
So I have three children. All three of them have one of my former coaches, mentors, as their godfathers. Our oldest godfather is Rick Furman, who was my childhood coach, just really the one guy teaching tennis in Lansing, Michigan when we moved there. And lo and behold, he was a genius. Rick went on to be the chief operating officer and executive director of the USTA. So, you know, not only a brilliant educator, but a brilliant tennis mind and businessman. Then when I turned professional, the USTA connected me with Jose Higueras, who you know well.
Oh yeah.
Jose is, I believe, the best teacher of tennis at the professional level that I've ever come across. He taught tennis in English, a foreign language for him, in the most simple terms. He took really sophisticated concepts and was able to break them down into very understandable content for all players. And I especially benefited under Jose's tutelage by having sparring partners that beat me up all day, every day. Guys like Jim Courier that just were relentless in our training sessions. And then I traveled with Dean Goldfein, who's now Sebastian Korda's coach. And Dean was less of a teacher and mentor to me. One, much more my age peer, but two, the best thing for me with Dean was he did his business exactly the same way every day. He attacked every day with great passion, kept me motivated. And was also the most important thing was he was humble enough to take Jose's concepts and try to apply them for my benefit, as opposed to saying, "Boy, I think you should be doing something different." There was always a great level of communication between Jose, Dean, and me, and it worked especially well.
It's great to have, the people that are willing to listen to other people instead of just following their own agenda, I think makes a big difference a lot of times. So we're kind of going into your pro career here, but I want to back up a little bit, different to some of your peers there. We're talking about Courier, Agassi, Sampras. You went to college for a couple of years. Tell us a little bit about that, what that meant for you. In moving into the pros?
Well, Pernie, listen, I had no other option than to go to college. I mean, you know, I was, when I my biggest leap in development in my youth was between the ages of 16 and 17. I went from being the 28th best player in the US in the 16 and unders as a 16-year-old to being, I think, probably in the top 20 of the 18 and unders when I was 17. That's a, you know, with all those older kids aging out, competing against young, older kids myself, that was by far the biggest leap I took. And that was not a significant leap. I mean, that, you know, it was very simply, I was so far away from what possibly could have been. So I looked for a school that I was going to be comfortable with the coach and the team and feel like I could develop. I went very much for an academic experience. Northwestern's one of the greatest schools in the country. And I saw an opportunity at, no matter how much I wanted to play tennis after college, I knew at some point in my life, I was going to have to do something else other than wear shorts to work. And in Northwestern, it really had all three things. It had a great coach and somebody that I could really trust as being responsible for me in my young adulthood and my sort of maiden voyage into independence. A team that was diverse and I would even say eclectic. However, they figured out how to get along and see things and pursue a common goal. And the academics were great, probably too good for me in the end. But it was a learning experience for me. I dealt with success on the tennis court. I dealt with failure in the classroom. I matured as a human being. I matured physically. I was able to develop my tennis. One of the things that was really important to me was not going to a school where I would end up playing five or six in the lineup. I wanted to play one or two. I played two my freshman year, one my sophomore year. I felt like I needed to be part of a team that had a chance to compete, but I also needed to be in a situation where I was provided the opportunities to continue to pursue my individual objectives.
And then you, did you feel when you left that you were ready for the pros? Or did you feel like, what was your thoughts on going in the pros?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I had what I would have called at number two singles in the Big Ten, which was not that strong back then. I had a decent year. I qualified for the NCAAs in the individuals, lost first round. You know, I was okay. The summer after my freshman year, I finished second in a satellite, you know, a series of what are now futures, which was a great result for me. I flew from there, from the like Tulsa, Oklahoma. I flew to New Haven, Connecticut. I won a challenger. I went back to Chicago and lost in the finals of the Winnetka Challengers. So I went from having what I would have said an average to acceptable first year in college to having an exceptional summer of competing as an amateur amongst professionals. Yeah. And had I been less mature, and I'm not thinking that I was really mature, but had I been less mature and had I had stars in my eyes, I would have turned professional right then because there was so much momentum. I was clearly on the right path and I clearly had developed quite a bit during that summer, which I think is more a testament to all the work that had been done during the collegiate year. My summer after my sophomore year, I went into NCAAs my sophomore year as the number one ranked player in college and didn't win the NCAAs. Started my summer in after my sophomore year, also not having committed to playing, turning professional. I started the summer great. I got mono nucleosis like in the second week. I went home for 3 or 4 weeks to recuperate. Fortunately, it was not a rough case. And then I started competing again later in the summer. And again, I had a great summer worth of competition against professionals and against a higher level of professional competition. And that's when I felt like it was time. If I, if I focused 100% on tennis, I did feel like I was going to make some pretty bold strides. I didn't. I failed for the first couple of years on tour and really second guessed my decision at times. Certainly struggled just coping with not having success at something that I had been having such success with. Went so far as to tell my dad that I couldn't do anything if I had to compete for money. You know, it was just like that, and it was all hogwash. And unfortunately, something sparked, something just, you know, two wires connected the right way one day, and a lot of things could happen from there.
Okay. Do you think it was a particular win, or was it just kind of an attitude thing where you...
So there's two things that I look back at with real positivity as far as what triggered was... I had a conversation, and this, not often do you hear an athlete give credit to an agent for what happened on the court. But I had a conversation with my longtime agent, Tom Ross. We were only 2 years in at the time. And I told him, I said, he said, your contract's coming up, your 2 year contract with the firm is coming up. And I said, yeah, please, you know, you don't feel like we need to extend. I'm not doing anything good for you. And I know I'm really struggling. So don't worry about it. And he said, no, it's an investment. We have made an investment in you and we want to continue that investment. You've done a lot of hard work. You're in a great environment with Jose and the general setting that the USTA had put me in. That was meaningful to me. It was, because I was negative on myself, to know that somebody saw a business future for my endeavor, not just, hey, you can, you know, I'm pretty sure you can get into the top 100. That's not what the agents are looking for. They're looking for top 20, top 10 talent. And then the other is I went down to the Australian, this is almost 2.5 years into being a professional in 93. I had just switched rackets. I went down there. I laid a few eggs, badly. I couldn't have played worse. I switched back to the racket that I had been using. And then in Memphis. So in February of 93 was my first final. I beat David Wheaton, Andre Agassi, Michael Chang, and then lost in a super close three-setter to Courier. And out of all of those, probably the three-set loss to Courier was the most encouraging for me. In that setting, with the pressure of being in a final against, if Jim wasn't number one in the world, he would have been close to number one in the world at the time. That was most encouraging. And then, just 2 months later, I won my first ever ATP event on clay down in South Florida. Oh, yeah, so sure, yeah. Coral Springs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so the notion that I had had really significant success in 1 week and sustained it. So in that first half of 93, I probably went from something close to 100 in the world in January to, I think I was top 15 by July. And that, I was never a rankings motivated. I was never a rankings based player. However, I looked at the rankings and I saw that I had gone from 100 to 15 or whatever it was. And I realized, you know, this is sustainable. Because I also didn't look at it and say, I've played out of my mind for this period of time. I played as well as I knew I could play, but I just sustained it. I was consistent day in and day out.
And I love the fact that you put a lot of weight and positivity towards a loss. I think it's underrated that people don't understand how much they can gain from certain losses and turn things around and or learn a lot from them. So
is this the time that we start talking about you beating me in the finals of Canada?
It depends a little bit how you answer a couple of questions coming up here, because I noticed how we ended your 93 year there in the summertime. We might have to start talking about late summer.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about the summer in 93.
So let me ask you, I'm going to wait a little bit when we talk about matches that you played. I want to touch a little bit more about practice. When you were on tour, did you have a favorite practice partner? What did your practice look like when you were on the tour?
So I'm 6'6". I was, when I turned professional, I was still growing. I was 20 years old, but I probably was not quite fully grown and certainly not fully mature from a physique standpoint. When I started with Jose, our week was Monday through Friday, two-hour sessions a day, plus some off-court stuff. Saturday morning, 2 hours in the morning, and then a day and a half off. I was not prepared for that physically. Imagine, you know, as a child, I was playing 6 hours a week. In college, I was playing 10 hours a week. 22 hours a week was too much for me at the intensity that we were keeping. Remember, I was training with Courier during that time. And Jim was by far the best practice partner I could have ever dreamt for. He set an example of what was controllable in his level of input. I mean, his attitude was great every day. His energy was perfect every day. And nobody had better focus. And because I was the guy that was taking all the blunts to the head from Jim, I had to demand more of myself, which was really beneficial for me. So as I grew, as I, let's say, finished becoming a physical adult, and as I matured in my own ownership of what was the best training regimen for me, I probably spent about 8 weeks, give or take, in a setting that was that Jose 22 hour week approach. But then I had other different types of weeks. That was in California, which I'd go out and I'd stay in a hotel room, the Days Inn Suites. I mean, it was Spartan. I had a hotel room. I got takeout. I went to practice. I'd be there for a month straight, put myself through the ringer. I'd be all the better for it. But then I lived in Florida at the time. And when I was in Florida, I'd go back and, totally discredited in my development was when I went back to Florida, I got to train with Brian Gottfried and Mal Washington. So, historical player, and Brian helping two guys who were on parallel paths in Mal and me. But that was Mal's training home. So he was going through the rigors in Florida where I lived. But I really benefited from leaving home to go into what would be more of like training camp, boot camp. When I was home, I'd practice very rarely twice a day, most times once a day, and be in the gym And this was not for months on end. It was, you know, to fill gaps between tournaments. So I was probably 2 or 3 weeks at a time like that. I probably took more time off the court than most of my peers. If I came home after 2 or 3 weeks, and if I didn't have another tournament for another 2 or 3 weeks, I took a few days off and just rested my body, rested my mind, and got myself motivated to get back after it.
I think it's important to have that balance. I think too many people think that they shouldn't go away from the game when they're, you know, like you say, you're trying to become better and better. But I think that time off is crucial at the right time.
Yeah, I looked at it as there were times to build and there were times to manage and there were times to rest. And yeah. I was very intentional about that.
That's great. All right. Easy questions.
What were the first ones?
Those were the difficult ones.
Okay. Just because they're so long ago, probably.
All right. Your favorite individual match win.
I actually think this is these are more difficult questions.
You think so?
I'll explain why. When I look back, when I talk to people about my career, I love the moments in the locker room. I love the moments on the practice court. I love the challenges that I faced in order to be prepared to be great. I don't have great, if you asked me midway through my career in 97, I would have been able to tell you every match, every score of the first half of my career, and probably most of my youth and college career. If you ask me at the end of my career, it was like a whiteboard more or less. So, my favorite match win, I had two wins at the US Open in the fourth round in 99 and 2000, one against Greg Ruzecki in 99 and then Carlos Moya in 2000. I was down two sets to love against both of them and came back and won in five sets second Tuesday night, both years. Those are the ones that stick out the most.
Okay. So then I'm going to give you an opportunity now. If you had one match you could have back, what would it be?
So I am the guy who finds it really difficult to embrace regret because, and I think you just spoke about it, because I value failure at such a high level. So I don't have regrets from a competitive standpoint. However, I lost in the semifinals of Wimbledon in 96 where against Mal, against one of my best friends in tennis, Mal Washington. I was up 5-1 in the fifth set and figured out how to let him back into the match. And what went from a momentary blip in execution bled into an all-out mental collapse, and probably the match that's most similar to that was against you in the finals in Canada in 93. And I think I was up 5-2 against you, and I think that was two breaks also, and it wasn't as much of a loss in mental control, but there was a loss of mental control. There was a loss of focus. There was a consideration of what do I say when I shake Michael's hands? What do I say when I speak to the crowd and I get the winner's trophy? What do I say in the press conference? What will my ranking be? Just massive distractions from the task at hand. I'll tell you, I had the best years of my career after I lost to Mal. I had a good year after I lost to you in 94. I had a great year. But when I lost to Mal, Rick Furman was actually at Wimbledon with me, and you know, what do you say to somebody who walks off the court that broken, and not only broken because of a lost opportunity, but broken because of the publicness of that opportunity? And Rick, in his typical way, was not sympathetic. And that I found not asympathetic, right? I mean, it was not like he walked in and, you know, gave me a hug and just, you know, patted me on the head and like, oh, that's too bad, you're great. You know, like it was, you've got a lot to learn. You've got a great learning opportunity here. And this is something that's beyond my capabilities. And this is something that's beyond your capabilities. Let's, if you're serious about wanting to be great, let's go get you in front of a sports psychologist and let's address this. Let's not run away from it. And that, that was not a week later. There was no opportunity for me to, you know, go away and be alone with my thoughts and feel sorry for myself. It wasn't at the locker room door, but it wasn't long after. And that, I got to tell you, as a business leader, I have a difficult time approaching coaching my colleagues with that same level of directness. It is a huge challenge for a human to be that motivated to help somebody develop, to say at their lowest time, dust yourself off. We're gonna use this.
Yeah. That's great. That's awesome. What is your absolute favorite day of tennis?
So there's two Davis Cup experiences that really stick with me, maybe even a third. And the third is when Pete Sampras came back from cramps. He won his Friday singles match on indoor slow red clay in Moscow during the finals. We ended up one all. I was supposed to play doubles with Richie Rennenberg. Pete went into a full body cramp the late afternoon, early evening, the night before. And he showed up the next morning and said, come on, let's go play some doubles. And Richie was like, great, Pete, you're in, you know, like Richie was super supportive. And Pete and I won a as doubles is in Davis Cup, a pivotal match against Olahovsky and Kafelnikov. That's one of them. But then the other two are, against Thomas Enquist in Las Vegas in 95, I think the semifinals Davis Cup that year. We ultimately won the Davis Cup that year. But I played doubles with Jonathan Stark on Saturday. Jonathan, as normal, was rock solid and played a good match. I felt like I was horrible and just really let him and the team down. Andre was injured and was unable to play Sunday against Enquist. We were up 2-1. I mean, Sampras and Agassi won on Friday. But I felt like I really exposed our team to a loss. And then I was subbed in spite of being not very good on Saturday, I was subbed in for Andre on Sunday, and I beat Thomas in three close sets. I think it was three sets. And that was a great moment for me. And then the third, sorry, you asked for one, but.
No, I'll take the third. I love listening to this. So you bring him.
I lost the third match against Australia in Boston in 1999, the 100th anniversary of the Davis Cup, where the Davis Cup started at Longwood Country Club or Cricket Club. And I lost to Pat. I had heat stroke or some form of heat illness, and I was Captain Gullickson, Tom Gullickson, was putting a substitute in for me. The doctor ultimately said, you can't substitute because there's no proof that the sickness is there, which back in the dark ages, that was the only reason somebody could be subbed out in Davis Cup, was if literally they could not take the court. So the doc, our team doc, squeezed a bottle of refrigerated IV fluids into me before going out on the court. It was 110 degrees. I was miserable, but I won the no idea how. I don't remember but one point in that entire match, but I won the first two sets against Pat. And even and I was even up a break in the fifth, but I was on fumes. But the fact that I was able to stick it out, represent the country as well as I could, represent myself as well as I could. There's only one time where I felt like I was in war, and it didn't matter how I felt. I had to keep going. And that was the day. And I lost the battle, lost the war for our team, but I did feel like that one moment gave me a more positive feeling about the human I am than any other match I ever played.
It's a wonderful memory. It's a loss, but it's it's just something to take with you for sure.
It is a loss.
Those are wonderful stories. Really love to hear them. And you've said so many things in this interview that kind of answers my next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What do you feel made you such a successful tennis player?
Well, it starts with parents. I'm obviously wired a certain way. And, I was born to be 6'6" and be able to do things with my hands. I was also born to be really, really slow. I am the slowest tennis player I've ever seen. But I do believe that it starts with parenting. My parenting instilled certain values in me that that established that I was supposed to do as much as I could with the talents, the God-given talents that I was born with. And then they were also incredibly discerning about who I spent time with in my early life. And that established in me the same. So throughout my life, I've chosen the people, whether it's friends, a spouse, coaches, peers, players that I hung around with on the tour. I've chosen those individuals well, and so nothing ever distracted me from a value system that was instilled when I was a very young boy. And as much as anything, I just didn't screw it up, right? My parents did a lot to put me on the right path, and I came close to maximizing it, but equally important, I just didn't do anything to screw it up.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Todd, I want to thank you so much. It's wonderful speaking to you. Wonderful to hear your stories and your memories and the way you, how you treated your career.
Pernie, you're the best, really, man. Fun. Always happy to talk to you.
Great. Great to see you. Take care of yourself, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks.
All right. All right, everyone. I'm Michael Pernforce. This is Open Mic. We'll see you next time, and don't forget the drop shot.